Yeah, that's exactly the idea. Thanks for the introduction. And that's why I put it in italics to give it a dramatic sense, and the fire as well, because that's what hot things and thermalization is all about. So the overview, just briefly, in pictures, the overview of my talk, I'm going to talk about three things: thermalization in quantum systems, or how I think is a nice way to approach that problem, and then two ways how you can break it down. One is self-generated glassiness, and the other one is the field known as many-body localization, basically systems with a lot of disorder and interaction. So if we think about thermalization or thermodynamics, we're actually talking about also statistical mechanics, because we know there are also a lot of small degrees of freedom. But in the end, thermalization means that irrespective of the initial state of my system, if I wait long enough, there's a loss of memory of what the initial state was. And only like temperature, pressure, and other macroscopic parameters matter. So the question is, how this actually works in quantum systems, because quantum systems have unitary time evolution. There is no loss of information whatsoever. So naively, you would say that it's impossible for a quantum system to thermalize. So how does that work? So there's been various ways that people have been thinking about it. One fairly recent way of thinking about it is called the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which states that if you have a eigenstate and you take the expectation value of a local operator in that eigenstate, it actually gives you the same value as if you just did the stat-mac ensemble value for that operator. But it's a hypothesis, as the name suggests, so it's still ongoing research whether this is actually true and which systems this works. Another way to approach it is try to generalize notions of why stat-mac works from classical systems, which goes under the name of chaos, which means that if you have two systems with slightly different initial conditions, at long times, they will be so much different that you basically forgot the exact detail of what your initial state was. So the way to quantify that is via out-of-time order correlations, and that's actually a fairly recent thing. Only last year, people started really thinking about that in condensed matter systems, I guess. Another way is to look at ideas related to integrability, which is also a classical idea, which is not very trivial to extend to quantum systems. One way that has been suggested is if you look at the so-called level statistics, so the distance between the energy levels in a quantum system, they follow a certain distribution, and from the distribution you can tell whether a system will thermalize or not. That is slightly related to the idea of how you would, in general, approach integrability in quantum systems. We know that in classical systems, if there are extensively many integrals of motion, you cannot thermalize simply because you retain the information of every integral of motion. But in quantum systems, you have to be careful because any quantum system, by definition, has extensively many integrals of motion. So how that works in quantum systems, you have to kind of quantify which integrals of motion you have to take into account and which one not. But these are all the vast field, and these are all fairly technical ways to approach this problem. And I'm a simple-minded man, so I want to do something very simple. Let's take a cup of tea. And if I put a cup of tea on a table, you know it will cool down. First hot, and the environment is colder, so it will cool down. So can we do something similar for quantum systems? So I gave the example of a cup of tea, but this is actually exactly what you do when you do an experiment. For example, I take a superconducting sample, or a sample that becomes superconducting once I put it in a fridge. If you put it in a fridge, of course, you want the sample to have the same temperature at some point as the fridge. So how fast will your sample get the same temperature as the bath surrounding it? And will it do anyway? So the setup that I'm thinking of is I'm going to do a quantum system where I have a hot system and immersed in a larger bath system. And the small system A will be a hot one, and the bath will be cold. It's a very simple system. And I'm going to ask the question, will that thermalize? So the initial state that I'm thinking of, I'm just going to do some quick page of math, and then we're going to be pretty pictures again. So the initial state will be just a density matrix where I have my subsystem A at a temperature TA and subsystem B at a different temperature. Personally, I like to not do with density matrix with the logarithm of that, because then you can simply write it like this. You don't need all these exponentials and things like that. The time evolution is just given by your quantum time evolution, and note that the minus signs of the time are opposite what you expect from Heisenberg time evolution. And for a non-interacting system, it's very simple. It's just phase evolution. So a non-interacting system, in general, you can write like this. You just have a quadratic modular Hamiltonian, which is the logarithm of the density matrix. And the time evolution of each operator is just given by a phase that you attach to that operator. And then from that, you just get a matrix, this MKK prime as a function of time. That's all there is, the information you need to know about the system, and then you can just compute it exactly. And that gives me four different scenarios that I can get. Well, actually, the first one is not a quantum scenario. The first one is just to give you an idea of what you expect if you would do the same thing in a quantum system. So in a classical system. So the classical would be to take...
I'm confused already.
Oh, sorry, no problem.
When you talk about non-interacting, you
yes.
mean it's a one-body Hamiltonian,
yes.
but it does not mean there's no interaction between system A and B.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. Good. So just go to the previous one. So there's a Hamiltonian here that gives time evolution. And if I think of it as sort of lattice, there's hopping like C dagger C, where one of them is in the system A and one of them is system B. In fact, I will take a Hamiltonian that's just translation invariant in the whole system. But my initial density matrix is, of course, not translation invariant. So what I show here is the energy density as a function of time and position. So red is hot, blue is cold, and everything in between. The idea is that, of course, initially I start with a very hot system here and a cold system here, and then the energy will spread out. So all the way to your left, you see what happens in a classical system, which is just diffusion following Fourier's law of thermal transport. If you then do a quantum system, the first thing that people always like to do is relativistic fermions. And relativistic things have a very nice property that everything propagates at exactly the same speed. So there you get what's called instantaneous thermalization. Once there's a causal contact between A and B, your system A is exactly at the same temperature as your bath originally. So that's not very interesting, I would say. So then we go to non-relativistic fermions, which is already slightly more interesting. What happens there is the particles still fly away in a ballistic way because they don't have interactions with each other. So actually the energy difference between what's the energy density in A and the bath energy density decays as a power law in this case, and the power law is given by what you expect from just ballistic propagation of energy density. So the power is one, is minus the dimension of your system. Now, if we, instead of fermions, take bosons, already something interesting is happening, which you would not expect from, if I would just tell you, I'm just going to do free particles, no interactions at all. The picture looks already quite similar to the ones, the diffusive one from the classical system.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So wouldn't the first picture never realistic in the sense that there's no causality, there's no locality in the diffusion equation? Because once you do some perturbation locally, then you feel instantaneous no matter how far away you are from that source. Just look at the slope of these boundaries. It seems that the slope approaches so there's no sharp defined boundary between the thermalized region and non-thermalized region in the first picture, is that correct?
In the classical picture?
Right.
No, you can do that because the diffusion equation you can just solve with a heat kernel. And then you can just multiply it you can just put as initial
right,
condition
so
any
no,
shape, so I can literally put a step function there. And,
right, but there's never a sharp boundary at any time between a region that doesn't feel the impact of the perturbation at the region that feels the impact of the perturbation. So there is no light cone, so to speak.
Oh, yes, there's no light cone.
But
yes.
In any quantum system, you want the there probably a light cone coming from the Robinson bound. Right?
True, but diffusion is always slower than a light. I would not, if you want to see diffusive effects, I would not worry about the light cone because you're going to be slower than that. These are basically the same setup, same energies, things like that. These are bosons, these are fermions. Here you see the light cone is basically what you see in the middle picture, or in this picture here. You don't see it here because it goes slower than that. To quantify what you see there with the bosons, let me just plot the energy density in subsystem A with respect to, as a function of time, for different bath temperatures. And if you have fermions, you always see very nicely this ballistic decay of the energy difference. If you do bosons, there's an interesting effect that if you make the bath temperature low, so low that the typical de Broglie wavelength is comparable to the interparticle spacing, you actually see a crossover to more diffusive behavior. and the diffusive is that the energy difference falls off as a power law, with the power being dimension divided by 2. We see that in 1 and 2 dimensions, we can just compute that all exactly. And this is an interesting signature that you already can see, that it's not exactly the same as you would expect from just ballistic particles propagating around. There's some interesting quantum effects, even in the non-interacting system already. So I talked to some experimental people, and I am trying to get them to actually do this. So the way to actually measure this in an experimental system is you take your favorite cold atom system, you tune it such that they're non-interacting, because that's what I computed so far. Then step one, you take your atom cloud. Then 2, you build a wall between 2 parts of the system. That's very popular nowadays. Then with a laser, you excite the sub region A. Then you remove the wall. You let the particles propagate. At a later time, you reintroduce the wall. You throw away everything. You throw away everything that's in system B. And then you do a time of flight measurement of the kinetic energy in system A. And that way, you can literally reproduce these plots from the previous slides. That's the way I get delta E. So this is non-interacting systems, which to many people are not very interesting, because non-interacting is sort of by definition not interesting. But I think you already get this nice trick of the crossover from ballistic to diffusive behavior. But we can take it to the next step. We can think about what happens if you include interactions. So in general, you expect that this modular Hamiltonian no longer only contains quadratic terms, it also contains quartic terms, cyclic terms, etc. It's going to be a mess. The same thing is if I look at how the operators change. These operators will still have this first term associated with a phase, but they also will be dressed with particle hole excitations and higher order things, and again, it will be a mess. The nice thing about thermalization, however, is that you expect that because of thermalization, at late times, this modular Hamiltonian will become just equal to your actual Hamiltonian, the one that you use for time evolution, divided by the effective temperature you have at the end of the system. Which means that all these higher order terms should vanish. And you can actually compute them. They do vanish much more rapidly than the other terms. So in that case, you only need also the expansion of these, how these operators get dressed with particle hole excitations, up to where I stopped here, the dots. So in that sense, that's something that I'm currently working on, getting these interacting non-integrable systems to thermalize. So that's basically what I just wanted to get a hint of. In general, you would expect a quantum system to thermalize. And they will thermalize in non-interacting systems with a power law. But when would they not thermalize? Because if even the completely integrable non-interacting system already thermalizes, when would you get no thermalization? So there are 2 things that you can basically have which can lead to breakdown of thermalization. One thing is if you include long-range interactions, so you can no longer strictly separate the system into subsystem A and a bath. That's one way you can go at it. And the other way would be to introduce disorder, which can cause localization that the particles really can't escape the subsystem A or the bath B.
So if you would have just a one-body Hamiltonian,
yeah,
and you don't take some nearest neighbor kind of thing, but you have made some going all across, would that be long range?
I was thinking of interactions, yes, but in that case, the initial state that I was thinking of, had this, you take a thermal state of system A, but then you need the Hamiltonian restricted to system A. And if you have long range hopping, say, between system A and system B, there's not much sense that I can call the system A at a certain temperature. I cannot really do that, because that would require me to thermalize already with.
But they can always define the reduced density of system A.
Oh yes, you can do that.
And is there not? That's what I understand. But that's what you're doing, because you have interacted.
Yeah, well, yeah, you can.
Not move at all, right?
Yeah. You can do that too. Yeah, in general, I think with hopping, I was actually thinking of interactions, but I think you're right that with hopping, it should not cause any big problems. I put a box around it because actually I was going to talk more about these long-range things at the moment. Let me just get to there. But before I actually going to talk about long-range things, I want to make a quick detour about glasses. Because glasses are one typical system that where thermalization breaks down. And I'm not talking about all the spin glasses that a lot of people, I think here also in the room, have thought about a lot of times. I'm talking about things like window glass, which you have a lot of in perimeter. Window glass is a non-equilibrium state of matter. And the way that you can get to that is because it has a first-order transition to a crystalline state. But this is basically the general diagram that you need to make a glass. You take a high-temperature liquid. You know that at some point it will have a first-order phase transition to a crystalline state. If you have a first-order transition, you can supercool it. So if you rapidly cool through the transition faster than the crystal can form, you'll enter into a regime where you're still liquid, where you're still liquid. And if you then cool further down, the relaxation time or the dynamical time associated with motion in that liquid will increase if you lower the temperature. And at some point, the time associated with that, the dynamical time scale of that liquid becomes so large that effectively it has frozen on any conceivable time scale, or at least conceivable experimental time scale. And that's what happens. That's how you make window glass. The recipe is take a first order transition and supercool it. So actually, we're going to do the same thing now, but then for electronic systems. And my inspiration came from an actual experiment done in an organic material, theta BDTF2 rubidium zinc. That material is organic molecules stacked in such a way that they effectively form two-dimensional layers with a triangular lattice. And it's known that this system has one electron per two molecules, or per two lattice sites. And if you just cool it very slowly, you see on the left corner, you see resistivity. At some point, it shoots up. There's a crystallization transition, or a charge density wave transition of these electrons. And they'll form a striped phase, as you can see in the picture next to it. However, what a group in Japan saw that if you cool it fast, you can avoid this first order transition of the electrons, and you go into a regime where the electron liquid is supercooled. And again, like I said, this is a supercooled liquid. If you cool it even further, it should slow down, and that's exactly what they did and saw. So what the top is a typical experiment they did. They rapidly cooled it to a certain temperature and then see how the resistivity of the system changes. So at some point, it will reach sort of a static value. It's not the equilibrium value, but it's sort of a static value. And it takes a certain time to reach that value. So that time, you can put on a plot as a function of temperature. And they put all of it on this very fancy plot. So this is one over the temperature. And this is the logarithm of that time. The reason why they do that is because that gives you the Arrhenius law if you have a straight line on this plot. The Arrhenius law just is a general indication of glassy dynamics in a system. And to give you an indication how slow this actually can be, already at 70 Kelvin, so the most right part of the plot, you will have a dynamical timescale of weeks, which is extremely long for electrons. Electrons don't go that slow, usually. So my question as a theorist is, how can you get such a breakdown of thermalization in such a system? Well, the starting point is, I know it's a triangular system. I know I have one charge per two lattice sites. So let me take the simplest thing I can imagine. I just have interactions. We know that these organic systems are very much interaction dominated. And the simplest interaction I can imagine is just the nearest neighbor repulsion between these electrons. And that is actually equivalent to the Ising model. If you just do a simple transformation to spins, where spin up would be occupied, spin down would be empty. We know that the Ising model on a triangular lattice has an exponentially degenerate ground state. So any state where a particle, it has six neighboring sites, on those six sites there are two other particles, any such configuration is a ground state. So you can have simple states, a stripe phase all the way on the left, or stripe in another direction in the middle, or you could have a very complicated, chaotic-looking state. But this is also one of the ground states of the Ising state. And there are, like I said, exponentially many of those. The problem is that if you start out from these kind of configurations, just the Ising model, and then you start to include the hopping, so the quantum hopping that you expect that these electrons can do, you will enter into a liquid-like state because there's no barriers between all these different configurations of this type. So they will just form one big macroscopic superposition, or not macroscopic, they just form one big superposition, and your ground state is a liquid, a correlated electron liquid, but a liquid nonetheless. And it's not compatible with this picture that we want of flowing down. So the idea that we have is fairly simple. We're going to increase the frustration that's already present in the icing model by including long-range interactions. So these long-range interactions, we expect them to be there anyway because it's a highly correlated system, so there's not much screening, and the electrons have, by nature, already Coulomb repulsed with each other. So the increased frustration that this long-range interaction gives us four already very nice aspects. So first of all, the ground state degeneracy is lifted. No longer I have this exponentially degenerate manifold, and actually, when we computed all the possible configurations that you can have, the ground state is now stripe ordered, exactly like what you see or what they see in the experiments, where the actual ground state is a stripe ordered phase of the electron. To get into the stripe ordered phase, the long range nature of the interactions forces the transition to be a first order transition. And that's actually also nice, because remember, I want to make glasses, and for that, you need a first order transition. And then all the other states would used to be ground states, but now are lifted. They become local minima. They are no longer, it's no longer free of energy to go from one to the other. No, they're all like in a local minima, and they become metastable state. So this is a system which has all the recipes for glassy physics. So given that we kind of expect glassy physics, we then turn on the computer and going to do some serious Monte Carlo simulations. The idea is that we just use classical Monte Carlo because the interactions are so much stronger than the hopping in these systems, and that we mimic the quantum hopping of the electrons by the Monte Carlo dynamics itself. So we're going to associate one Monte Carlo sweep, where we update all the whole configuration, with a unit of time in a unit of real time. So the interaction that we did is actually slightly more complicated than before. We introduced a parameter x that allows us to tune between just this pure icing limit, where we only have nearest neighbor repulsion, and a pure Coulomb long range still. And then we measured the so-called autocorrelation function. It's usually something you do anyway when you do Monte Carlo simulations, but now because we associate a sweep with an actual physical time, we're going to extract some physical time skills out of that. So the idea is you start your simulation, so we rapidly cool it to a certain temperature. Then we wait a certain waiting time, tw, and then at time t late after this tw, we compare the two configurations, and that gives you, that should decay in general as a function of the distance between these two times. And that's what you see here on the, here on the left top. That's this decay, and from this decay we can extract a typical time scale of how long it takes for the system to relax. But this relaxation time in units of Monte Carlo sweeps that we get actually follows pretty straight the Arrhenius law that we expect for a glassy system. So this Arrhenius law, in fact, one fun thing that we got is that the gap, the delta in the Arrhenius law formula that we get, is actually pretty similar to what you find in experiments. And we're also confident that this is an effect of the long-range interactions, because then when we tune the this parameter x that allows me to go from long-range to nearest neighbor icing, you actually see that it goes to zero. So there's no Arrhenius behavior if you do this for the icing system. There is Arrhenius law behavior when you do this for the Coulomb interaction. So since we have this model and we have this nice Monte Carlo results, we just started to work with this model a little bit more. And one of the experiments I showed you was conductivity. So one way that we wanted to do conductivity is we thought, well, we can just do DMFT. It's a very popular tool anyway. And DMFT stands for dynamical mean field theory. I'm not going to explain you the details about that. The E, however, stands for extended, which is a method that you can include these long-range Coulomb interactions into the DMFT machinery. And in fact, in this case, we can even make it simpler because the interactions are so strong, we can treat them as sort of a, we can treat the hopping again as a perturbation. So you get a sort of semi-classical limit of EDMFT equations, which you can solve in an afternoon. And then you get this very nice resistivity plot where, again, if you have stripe order, you see this nice first order jump in the conductivity in the resistivity. But you also can get the super cooled state, which is, again, qualitatively the same as you saw in the experiment.
So how distinguish these two states in the MFA?
So you can incorporate an order parameter theme. So you just put in the stripe order parameter.
So you regard the non-symmetric broken base as the
yes.
As
so what variant of DMFT is that?
So extended DMFT. So it's a variant where you have a bosonic field as well, which in that case would be the Coulomb integral. So the final thing I want to say about this class is that we have this model, so there's a lot of things we want to do with this model, and we're still working on a lot of things. So one thing that I can already show you that we're putting out pretty soon, I guess, is a simple question: how does the single particle states of this guy look? It's known for disorder glasses that have this nice Efros-Klosky gap for people who are into that. What we see is a different kind of gap, but still a soft gap. So the density of states goes to zero, but in a non-trivial way. There's not a hard gap, as in what you would expect in the crystalline phase. In general, since we have so many metastable states, we're interested in how does this manifold of metastable states look? How are they connected? Are there processes that go from one metastable state to another? And that is then closely related to the other ways of thinking about thermalization. Is this really a thermalization breakdown? In the sense, for example, EPH. Does the eigenstates of the system, which is very hard to do because it's a two-dimensional system, so no idea yet how to approach that problem exactly, but are the large system eigenstates actually giving the same as you would expect from a thermal ensemble? And which thermal ensemble should I do then? Should I respect stripe order or not? And how is this related to quantum chaos? If I start with one of these metastable configurations and let time run, will there also be some kind of Lyapunov divergence going on? So these are all questions on this Galassi system that we still like to explore. And they're all underlying the most basic glass question of all. Is there a true glass transition? So with the true glass transition, I mean that there's actually a divergence of this relaxation time at some point, some temperature. And that's, I think, one of the major open questions in this field. And we've got a model now that seems to display a lot of features of glassiness. So if we push this model a little bit harder, at least we can find an example of a system that might have a true glass transition.
But the relaxation was Arrhenius and not Vogel-Fulcher, right?
Yes, but that's something. The point is that you only know it up to some point, right? You can always, you only do it up to weeks. No one can say that perhaps if they were able to measure it between years and millions of years, that it then actually becomes a divergence at some finite temperature. That's the difficulty about just Arrhenius.
A simple question?
Yeah, of course.
About your updates, this pseudo timescale you get will depend strongly on the kind of updates you make in a
yep.
global or global. You might miss the class if you fancy it.
Oh, yes. So, because.
So, what do you do that? I mean, you take the simplest type of things that would happen in a cooling, supercooling something, and then local moves?
Yes, yes, we do local moves exactly because we want to mimic this, the actual quantum hopping. So, the simplest quantum hopping we expect is just nearest neighbor hopping between electrons. So that's also the update.
So you put it in?
Yes, we put it in. Yeah, of course. So you would get a completely different picture if you do cluster updates.
I'm a bit confused about this system because I think I look at this as a quantum system.
Yeah.
You have eigenstates. These eigenstates would be not metastable. They would be rigorously stable. They would not decay in time. There's nothing to do. So the system, so what you look at, I am very suspicious of it that you might see this stuff because you're not doing the quantum dynamics or whatever you do exactly. You do some approximation and so you get some dynamics that's actually may not be real because it's all due to the approximations.
That might very well be. But the question is, starting from a, you need to rapidly cool to get into glass anyway. So you need to start what in quantum literature you would call a quench, right? Start from some product state, and you'll see how correlations start to develop over time. So those correlations will build up over a certain time scale, and that's the time scale we're trying to probe. And I think this method, because if you would just trotterize your time evolution, what would happen is you start out with a configuration, and then I'm going to do Monte Carlo sampling of this charterized. So I'll start to make world lines in your classical configuration space. So the question is will I go to different parts of my configuration space and lose all correlations altogether, or will I kind of stay in the same part of, with configuration, I mean the basis of classical state, right?
Actually. Can totally see, because this eigenstate picture, nothing interesting
exactly
happens, but if you go to another basis, then you might see all kinds
exactly
of
interesting. Yes, and that's the quench we're trying to do. So high temperature, just back product state, infinite temperature. So starting for the infinite temperature, I take my product state, and then trotterizing it, making world lines where particles hop, and then trying to put that on a Monte Carlo is actually kind of similar.
Hard spheres, you have alpha and beta relaxation, two time scales,
yeah,
cosmic temperature. I don't know. Do you see things in your model?
Yeah, so I always forgot which one's the alpha and which one's the beta, but
cluster type of rearrangement versus slow diffusion.
Yes.
Cage rearrangement, but here we don't have cages yet.
Yeah, so we don't really have cages. We also don't see this kind of, let's put it this way. We do see a separation in time scales, because there is a certain time that you need to wait after you start the quench before the system starts to behave without knowledge of how long it has been waiting since the quench. But then still, it's pretty slow. So there are like two time scales. And how they're related to what you do in hard spheres, that's something I'd. Okay, thanks for all the questions. I like that. Keep up the question. My comments about a true glass transition actually refer to what people know there is a true glass transition in a highly disordered system, what you usually refer to it when you say spin glasses or electron glasses. So disorder, if you remember, there was the other way that I was trying to break down thermalization. So that's the third part of my talk. It's going to be about breaking down thermalization due to disorder. And the starting point for me is always Anderson localization. Just to briefly review, Anderson localization is if you just, I prefer lattices, just take a lattice, you have electrons hopping on that lattice, but there's on site a random energy, a random chemical potential. And Anderson showed that the single particle wave function on this system are exponentially localized around sort of a center site. This means it's still a completely non-interacting system, so I can easily diagonalize the system exactly. So you get this shape if you diagonalize it exactly. And these n tildes are now these occupation numbers of single particle wave functions, which are local. So it means that if I locally occupy this wave function with a particle, this particle will never diffuse, because these guys commute with the Hamiltonian object. So the presence of so-called the local integral of motion prevents the system to thermalize. And that's a general wisdom that applies to any system. If you have integrals of motion that are completely local in some part of your system cannot thermalize, because your system locally will always remember what the initial state was. So many-body localization is a term that refers to what happens if you include interactions in an Anderson insulator. So start with this already diagonalized Anderson insulator and just add some random interactions that do not commute with these Anderson operators. The picture is that these integrals of motion that you have now are dressed by these interactions. So they become more complicated and more messy, but as long as the interactions are weak, it's been shown that these integrals of motion are still local. So that's what's called many-body localized phase. And it's not thermal, and there's various ways that people have shown that it's not thermal. One way is that actually if you start out with a product state, entanglement will grow, or entropy will grow in a logarithmic fashion as a function of time rather than linear, which you would expect. Another obvious one is that it is an insulator. It's a perfect insulator, the conductivity is exactly zero. So of course you can no longer write your Hamiltonian if you write it in terms of integrals of motion like that, but there's a simple way that you can do that here. Where now these tau z's are integrals of motion. For some reason, people like to dress them as spins, so they're sometimes also called L bits, or localized bits. So not only have a quadratic part, which would be this part, I would also have interactions between all these L bits. And my question is, can we compute those guys? Can we compute what these L bits are? And can we compute what these interactions between these guys are? Because that will really quantify what we actually mean and how this formalization works. So in general, every Hamiltonian that exists in the world, I can find a unitary transformation that will bring it into this form. This is just a general statement about a lattice Hamiltonian. The question is how to get that. And people originally worked with perturbation theory, so that's always your go-to thing if you start with something. The problem with perturbation theory in this sense is that it can fail due to so-called resonance. So one way I write down perturbation theory is you have these electron operators, and they get dressed by particle Hall excitations, and you, in this expansion in second order, you get typically terms like this, where this V is the interaction term, and the size are all the energy, the single particle energies associated with that.
The powers themselves, they are commuting operators.
They're commuting with each other and with Hamilton.
Yes, and they are emitting.
Oh yeah, they're emission.
And so such a Hamiltonian has eigenstates that are purely product of single particle states in this style.
Yes. Yes, in the style basis they are. Yeah.
Yes.
And you can do this for any Hamiltonian. If you want, I can go through the detailed proof. But let's do that separate. But it's kind of a trivial realization if you just count all the possible states for that. I'm glad. I know. It is a surprise statement, but yeah, if you want, we can sit if we have some time at the end, I can do it in more detail. It's actually just...
So this is true for any second quantized Hamiltonian?
Yes.
Something special about lattice Hamiltonians that I'm not
aware of? The reason why I say lattice is because at least I can count. If you have a continuous one, I don't know how to count.
No,
I can say it.
Discrete data, fine with that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very elaborate relabeling of all the eigenstates that I'm doing.
So the question is, are these tau's sort of local in terms of the original?
Exactly.
Yes. Right?
Exactly. At the end of this slide, I will put the expansion, how to get that. I'll just put it up right now. So you can, in the end, expand this tau z's in terms of the original operators. And the question is, of course, what are these guys?
I see what I'm missing. These tau's are not one body operators.
They're very complicated, messy, exactly. Yeah. So let me get back to perturbation theory, because I was talking about how to get these guys. In general, that this factor, if the denominator is small, it will diverge. And then you can no longer do perturbation theory. So our idea was actually to take another approach, to do consecutive smaller unitary transformation. Don't try to find the big unitary transformation at once, but just many smaller ones. And the idea is you just take an interaction term, you find a parameter lambda, which is a very well-defined parameter if you compute it like this, and then you do what's called a displacement transformation with this operator, which is something we can do exactly, and all the new terms, so you, with this, you remove that interaction term for your Hamiltonian, and you only generate new terms that have smaller couple. In that sense, it's a very nice way of term by term eliminating all the off-diagonal elements for Hamiltonian. It's a flow equation, yeah. You can also view it as a Wigner flow, some people. But it's like a discrete version, because we do just one step. So, of course, I don't want to reinvent exact diagonalization in a very complex way. So at some point, you need to do some kind of approximation. And the approximation we choose is to stop just at some point with the number of operators that are involved in the term. So if I stop, for example, at what we call fourth order, we only have the Hamiltonian that looks like this. So we only have just the two integral of motion interaction, and the tau z's are up to like c dagger c. But then the question is, what are these jij's and what are these alpha parameters? The interactions between the integrals of motion and the how integrals of motion are expressed in the original base.
Once you have it in this form, can you immediately write down what the eigenvalues are of the Hamiltonian?
Yes. So eigenvalues are, like you said, they're just product states. So you just occupy these tau z's with you just say the plus or minus one, and then you just get a sum of all the possible psi's and jij's. And actually, I didn't put it in the slides, but we then compared it on small systems with exact diagonalization, and you do get relatively good accuracy if you stop here, and then we can see you get an order of better order of magnitude better accuracy if you just take the next term in the expansion as well. So it's a very nice convergent way of doing it by approximation.
So yeah. It's nice and convergent even in systems which are completely obeying ETH.
Yes, it still works. Our method. So I'm gonna on the next slide. I'm gonna go to the actual model that we compute, which is the standard model that everyone studies for MBL, and we still can compute these guys if you go into the ergodic regime. At least when we look at exact diagonalization, the energy values are good, but there will be a surprise about the problem. So I will get to that. So the model that we do is like I said, the standard model of MBL, which is the Anderson insulator plus nearest neighbor repulsion, where the only thing random here is the on-site energies, which are in between some parameter W, which a uniform distribution given by this parameter W, which quantifies how much disorder I have. So there are two things that I plot here. On the left side is the spread of the integrals of motion. So the way we computed this is you take your integral of motion, or approximate integral of motion, this tau z guy, and you multiply it by your original density operator at a given site. And then you take the trace over that guy. So if you take those integrals of motion and the original density operators at different sites, it should decay as a function of the distance between these guys. And indeed, it does. And in fact, it seems to decay pretty much exponentially for all values of disorder. So blue is less disorder, and red is a lot of disorder. The only thing that changes is the localization length, but it seems to be pretty much it seems to be pretty localized throughout the phase diagram. And this model, like you asked, has a very interesting phase transition where the total many body eigenstates seem to be localized around 3.5 W. That's based on other models, other people's computations. But we don't see that here. And also, if you just look at the interactions between these guys, which you see here on the right, you also see that it's always nicely exponentially decaying for all values of W. And I can just extract the localization length from these and then put that all in one plot. So the localization length associated with the interactions is the green line. The localization length associated with the left plot, so this trace tau z I n j, is the blue line. So it becomes much, much larger than the one electron localization length which you expect from Anderson localization. But still, there's no hard transition. Now, I have to give one warning, because what I showed you are the typical properties. So of course, when I compute this, I average over many disorder realizations, and I average over many possible sites that I have in the system. And I do large systems up to 60 sites. The values that we plot here are the median of all the possible values that we get. So the problem with delocalization is that you don't actually need all of the states to be delocalized. You only need a few of them. So the typical values actually don't show a sign of the transition. However, if you go to the average values, which are much more susceptible, then you get a mess. So when we try to compute the average values of, for example, these interactions between the integrals of motion, so these jij parameters, we couldn't get anything with a small error bar. It's a complete mess, even if you do thousands of disorder realizations. And the reason that we found that is if we look at actually the distribution of these jijs. So the interactions between the integrals of motion at a given distance, so here distance 10 sites and here is distance 20 sites. Let's look at the 10 sites first. You see that the distribution follows a very closely 1 over j distribution. And the problem with the 1 over j distribution is that it doesn't have a well-defined average. Depends on the cutoff. So, and similarly, we see that for all disorder strength, if you are close by, but if you go to further away distances, the weak disorder, so it's the purple line here, they still have consistently this 1 over j distribution of the interactions. Whereas if you go to strong disorder, it follows a nice exponential decay, which is very, very nice. So that suggests to us that the way we should think about this transition in terms of these integrals of motion is that there's only very few of them that could mess up the whole system. Looking at typical values will not, or typical properties of integrals of motion will not give you properties about this delocalization transition. That's something we're, that's like the next thing we're going to do, because getting averages for crazy distributions like that is very hard. So, got a question?
Right. I mean, people started this using exact diagonalization as well, and there you can check if there's, you know, mobility edge or however you call it. So you could just manually see how many states are localized or not, and then compare with how much your method fails.
So the sort of tricky part is, there's a lot of things you can say about that. But the problem is, if you do exact diagonalization, you have to be very careful what part of your spectrum you look at. It's not just a many-body mobility edge in energy. There's also a many-body mobility edge as a function of density. Because obviously, if I take a density which is lower than, if I take a density that's so low that the interparticle spacing is larger than the single particle localization length, the whole system is still localized. And integrals of motion should respect that. So even though the integrals of motion are just operators, right? They don't tell you in what part of my phase space I am. So they should somehow still give me localized answers if I don't occupy them too much. But if I occupy them more and more, they should give me delocalized. So there's only very few parameters in this whole, if I go back to this. So there's only very few parameters here that are responsible for what happens exactly at half filling, where most of the numerics are done. And that's why you need to be very careful how you're going to actually probe this. Just simply looking, I'm just going to look at the typical value, you throw away so much wealth of information that doesn't respect the richness of how integrals of motion work. In general, I would say the delocalization is actually an interesting thing in the MBL perspective. Most people have been studying the MBL phase, but I think the fact that I think we should call many-body delocalization, because that's actually what's happening, right? Start with a localized system, you introduce interactions, you put a lot of particles, and then it delocalizes. So, but I don't think we can change the name of a field that easily. So the questions that we already discussed this guy. This is one of the open questions that I've been thinking about a lot. The nice thing is, as I said, I can also compute at least these guys in delocalized phase. They're very strange properties, and there's still a lot of things we can study about it, but I at least definitely want to go there to systems that are completely disorder-free, like the Hubbert or Heisenberg or Condell lattice model, which might have very interesting properties if you just look at integrals of motion at least. And finally, another way, and that's a much more practical way, we found this way of doing this so-called displacement transformations. If I just combine them all into one formula, what you're doing is actually you're writing down trial wave functions of this one. This is a different kind of trial wave functions. It looks in spirit maybe it's a bit similar to a matrix product state, but it's a very non-local form of a matrix product state. And we might be able to, we see this as a sort of systematic extension of what you would do with Hartree-Fock methods to get a new set of trial wave functions. So that's what I want to do with this method. I'm nearing the end. I want to acknowledge my collaborators, which are a lot of them. First of all, my former PhD supervisor, Yanzana, people in Florida, Vlad and Sami, and people in France, and Zora Nusinov. And now I work with Leon Balance in Santa Barbara, and Miguel and Andres in Spain help me a lot with all the MBL stuff. So, prepare 45 minutes. Seems to be good timing right now. The summary. In general, you expect the quantum system to thermalize, and I showed that you get that even with non-interacting systems, with the funny surprise that bosons have this crossover from ballistic to diffusive behavior. I showed you a model of a self-generated glass where you needed frustration and long-range interactions to get this Arrhenius law slowing down. And finally, I talked about many-body localization with Quench disorder, and I talked about how you have these typical versus average properties of integral motion, which are just very subtle thing. So I want to thank you for your attention and all your questions. So, thank you. So, are there more questions?
So could you please
go to the slide showing the stride base in the chart in this organic incident?
Yeah.
Right. So I was wondering what determines the periodicity of the stride in this model with both near stable repulsion and this non-range co-interaction. So what determines the characteristic wavelengths of this?
In this case, just a feeling. There's no competing interaction like you sometimes have in their proposals for glassy models where you would have, for example, short-range attraction and long-range propulsion. So in that sense, you can get a competition which gives you a changing wave vector as a function of how strong these guys are. But in this case, they're both repulsive. So they both just want to get the electrons as far away from each other. So the only thing that sets it is the filling. How much electrons do I have on my lattice? In this case, because I have, well, it's called quarter filling, but that might be sometimes confusing. So if I have one electron per two lattice sites, it means that the periodicity is two lattice sites.
This answers that you wrote down on your last slide, more or less.
Yeah.
So this is something that I am familiar with. So around 2000, these methods were proposed in the quantum chemistry community.
Oh.
And they are, they were published in different letters. And so one of the titles of this paper, now I was the author. It says, can the exact eigenstates of many body Hamiltonian be represented by essentially exponential two body operators? And that's exactly what you have.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
And so, what we could show, if you can solve certain equations, nonlinear equations, if these equations have solutions, these solutions will be exact. But they are nonlinear equations, so I could not say if you can solve them. But that's how far the proof went. People did lots of numerical simulations, and results were accurate, but the results were extremely hard to obtain. And that might all be numerical stuff, how you actually solve these things. So I think the field kind of died out. People were excited about it for a while, but it seems like it's very closely related.
Yeah.
And so it's a general second one that's operator. They were always acting on, say, a single term, which also happened. You can change the term and do it like that. So, so I think it might be, definitely something to kind of look up what this stuff is, and it looks like you have much better algorithms to solve these things because you can get your solutions. You know, people were running some nonlinear optimization. They were running for months for fairly small systems, so this would absolutely be terrible.
Yeah.
The results are very accurate, but terrible to converge.
Okay, that is definitely interesting. Yeah, we do have my collaborators in Spain. They do most of the code writing, to be honest, and they showed me already some graphs where they're on small systems, where they compared like the ground state energy using Hartree-Fock, using this method, and using exact diagonalization, and we can just see that. We get an order of magnitude better than Hartree-Fock, but still be faster than EB. So, yeah. I'd love to. Let me write that down later.
So I have a question about these over two glasses. So let's imagine that there's an infinite number of models that one can construct in the standard Eisenpike model, where it would be a competing state and many competing states, and as you cool them down, let's say with some kind of local dynamics, and control for this or blobber, they would freeze. But we would know that somehow the ground state is non-degenerate. So there's an obviously an infinite number of models that could fulfill that criterion, right? So then the question is there a way to classify the type of systems in terms of their approach to glassy behavior from as you cool them down? Yes, maybe that, because I'm trying to understand what would be a generic question one would ask that could not be subject to, what about this type of dynamics, what about this detail? So is there a classification of the, like if you consider all models for which there would be a unique ground state, then still dynamically you can not reach it because of the equilibrium and local dynamics. then the classification scheme that one can imagine? Has it been done?
So I don't think it has been done, but one thing that I've been thinking of is...
So people interested in glass forming materials, like Mezar and Paris and these guys, they look at multiple spin interaction terms, which tend to form glassy behavior. And you can imagine that if you integrate up, for example, the quantum hopping terms that would generate these many-body terms. So what's a crisp question one could ask here?
It's funny that you mentioned it. I discussed it with Parisi, and we came up sort of with this looking at the structure of metastable states. So when you say metastable, you have to define what I mean by that. So in that sense, you can have different classifications. So if you would define metastable in an isotype model as if I flip, if I do one spin flip, or like two spin flips, like one particle hopping, so two spin flips, which states are stable in the sense that all possible two spin flips that I can do from this configuration will cost me energy. So I can define that as a metastable state. I can also take like two or so four spin flips or eight spin flips. I can make that. And of course, if I more and more include more and more spins, at some point, I will only have the ground state as a stable state. So you need you can say, well, if my system has exponentially many metastable states with respect to single particle hops or with respect to two particle hops, those I think would be different classes of how stable a glass would be. That's at least I looked at this model. It does have an exponential with respect to single particle moves. We didn't look at the two particle moves, but I know, for example, that if you go to six particle moves, you can go from one metastable state to the other. So then they start to form a nice manifold.
Yeah.
But that manifold is much more interesting than, for example, the manifold you get if you allow for six particle moves in, for example, spin ice. Because that's, I can talk about it for hours.
But it's also topological sector issues that will come in some cases.
Oh, yes, exactly. And then you have to think also about that. But that would be, I think, a classification on the sort of structure of the manifold of metastables.
Following the discussion, but wouldn't the scaling of energy barrier height with respect to distance between two metastable states actually matter for the glass formation in this case, right? I mean, suppose I have lots of these metastable states, but there's a finite energy barrier separating those states. And I know there won't be any glass because any finite temperature is always the chance for a system to hop from one state, metastable state, to the other. However, if the scaling is such that it's getting hotter and hotter, or exponentially harder to go from one to metastable state to another far away metastable state, and I would imagine there's some sort of a glassiness in the system.
Yes, but you have to also define what you mean by far away. And
right, so there's
why
a notion of
certain number of particles.
Right. So there's definitely a notion of distance, and I think what I'm trying to say is on top of that, there's also a notion of the height of the energy barrier separating these metastable states, particularly how they scale as we go to further and further away, trying to go from one metastable state to further and further away metastable states.
So the it's also something you have to be very careful how you define it, because the take for example the models that we have here. What I can do is I can start out from a configuration where every single particle move will cost me energy, then you can either say, okay, I'm just going to go the distance. I'm allowing for six particle hops. Then there's no such thing as an energy barrier, right? Because I just do the six particle hop, and then I'm already there. So I'm at another metastable state with roughly the same energy. So if you want to talk about energy barriers, you have to say, well, okay, what I mean by that is, for example, I'm going to do consecutive single particle hops. Every particle hop will change the energy of my configuration. So as a function of how many hops I do, I just have a sort of hill landscape. And then actually I try to compute that. It turns out that the maximal height is actually kind of constant. You just have a typical energy scale. So the nearest neighbor repulsion here, let's say call it one. You just do one hop, you get an order of that energy that will cost you, then you're out of the manifold of metastable states, and you can basically move around freely there until a point where you kind of fall into another metastable state and you gain that energy one again.
Yes, this discussion reminds me of the model from Moore, the so-called window glass model, where you actually can show the energy barrier scales linearly with the distance between two metastable states in some sense. But we can talk about that later.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a question. Oh, yeah, keep interrupting, Marcel. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
About thermalization. So you had the thermal density operator for A and B, and beta A and beta B were different.
Yeah.
So if they were very close, shouldn't we just recover the fluctuation dissipation theorem and get relaxation to equilibrium from equilibrium correlation functions, time correlation functions, some operator? Partitioning. What do you think of situations where the two betas are quite different, that they're not close? They are very close.
Yeah. I don't know. I can see where your question comes from, because eventually what you want is that, of course, in generic non-interacting, non-integrable systems. Let's do it here. This diffusion constant, you would expect it to behave like this, right? Because the world around us behaves like this, even though the world behind around us is quantum mechanical. So the diffusion constant is a ratio of correlation, right? It's specifically it's the the kappa, the thermal conductivity, and the specific heat is in there, and that's just Kubo formula. So there should be because strictly speaking, this is indeed only for infinitesimal temperature. That's where you want
to
go.
Interested in all differences in beta, I guess.
Yeah, so I just went for this extreme case because in the end I was thinking about this glass problem where you rapidly cool to a certain temperature, so you have a large temperature difference.
What I talk about would be more adiabatic rather than sudden.
But yeah, more adiabatic and quench. But in the end, that's where you want to go, I guess, to have, like, from just first principles quantum mechanics. To get free.
So in the formula you wrote, this exact decomposition of Hamilton in terms of these tau, their average, I can see one very simple parameter. If I diagonalize the full Hamiltonian, I get my Hamiltonian in the diagonal exactly this form, and I have only one tau. But I have a tau for each eigenstate, and it has this form.
Oh, yes,
correct.
Yeah.
And so this is one way.
Well, I insist on having, if I have a lattice model with n sites, I insist on n with these tiles and not 2 to the n number of tiles. So this is this, because you're already thinking of that, let me call all these projection operators onto eigenstates, right? Those would be, because I have a charge conservation, each eigenstate has a certain number of particles. So let me just call n is the eigenstate index and k is the number of particles in that eigenstate. So I can write this guy always as the product of k of these tau z operators.
You're demanding that.
You're demanding that. That's one way. That's why I said the proof of doing that is just an elaborate way of relabeling it. I'm going to relabel all the projection onto eigenstates in terms of these tau z.
And so the number of tiles is, of course, related to the number of particles in the system. That is kind of how far you have to go.
Yes. Because I have n tiles, and I have n over 2 products of 2 tiles, n over 3, etc. So if you just count of all the possible combinations of tiles that I can make, it's again 2 to the power n, which is all the projection.
I see. It's a very simple counting argument.
Yes.
Any further questions? Okay, well then let's thank Luke again.